Roz is a active socialist here in Melbourne. She's been active for many years, including years ago when I was still here. One of the organisers of this fantastic conference. So she's going to speak for about 30 minutes and not plenty of time. So, yeah, kick it off, Roz.
Okay. I'm going
to start up here. Oh, wow.
Okay, so given the fact that it is 7:15 on a Saturday night and it's a room full of people listening to a talk about why are people so apathetic, I think maybe we've got some good signs that maybe the premise of the question is not entirely legit. We'll see where we go with that. I want to start off with a quote that I want you to guess what decade they're talking about. What is peculiar to the apathetic decade is that people have increasingly looked to private solutions to public evils. Private ambitions have displaced social aspirations, and people have come to feel their grievances as personal to themselves, and similarly, the grievances of other people are felt to be the affair of other people. If a connection between the two is made, people tend to feel in the prevailing apathy that they are impotent to effect any change. Anyone want to guess the decade?
60s.
1950s. And the author? No, that would be... that would be very impressive. But some of you will have read this person, E.P. Thompson, and the book was called Out of Apathy, published in 1960. And actually, when you start to Google apathy, as you know, you start any good research from talking. There's quite a lot of quotable things about apathy. How about this one? The only necessary thing for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Who said that one? No. Apparently, Edmund Burke. But then.
Oh, what? No.
But then actually, that's like a fakey quote. John Stuart Mill, in fact, definitely did say in 1867, bad men need nothing more than to compass their ends. That means, like, get away with bad shit. Than that good men should look on and do nothing. So it's sort of a bit of a hatchet job, the fakey quote. Albert Einstein, the world will not be destroyed by those who do evil, but by those who watch them without doing anything. That's a pretty highly used quote as well, as the necessary for the triumph of evil, blah, blah, blah. They don't say that after that Einstein wrote, the economic anarchy of capitalist society as it exists today is, in my opinion, the real source of the evil. Rather than the people who stand by and do nothing. But, in all seriousness, with as we know, the world on the brink of climate catastrophe, the clock is ticking, Trump is tweeting away, the far right is growing in confidence, we've got an Australian federal election which is basically bananas in different coloured pyjamas. So, we need to work out, why are people apathetic? Can we do anything about it? Newspaper commentators like to say, we're having a generation apathy. Ooh, the millennials. Again, this is nothing new. Like teenagers, invented in the 1950s, basically, as like a category of people. Always the apathetic ones, always selfish, self-centered, don't want to do anything to help others, blah, blah. And I'm sure we've all been told at some point or another, because we're all political people, being as this is a Marxism conference, that you've had the experience trying to convince someone come to a protest, attend a meeting, join a union, share a bloody post on Facebook, or actively demonstrate that they care about anything, and failing to convince them to do those things. And you've probably even had people take the piss out of you because you care too much. You try too hard. You spend too much time. You're too hyped up. Why do you get so worked up about everything and all of that? And it can make you feel a bit frustrated. And it is quite tempting to write people off as being shit if they don't do those things. But I do think there's a lot more that we can think about to do with apathy. What it is, what we can do about actually for me, as a Marxist, there's something about the inherent humanism of Marxism that keeps me sane and keeps me going as an activist. And if we believe, as Marx did, and the many activists who have taken Marx into the subsequent struggles, that socialism is the self-emancipation of the working class, we have to confront this question of apathy. So I'm going to talk about political apathy, not whether people work hard enough, try hard enough in personal relationships, save hard enough for their first home, although some of these things are connected. The very basic starting point for Marxists is there's nothing natural about apathy or alienation. And that might sound like a simple proposition, but outside of the Marxist tradition, there are a range of alternative arguments. And I'll give you five, not in any particular order, examples of other things that people say. One, people are selfish and greedy by nature. You could do a whole other talk about that to fill up a whole session, but I will come back to something about that. Two, there are individual psychological explanations. People are depressed, their brains are dysfunctional, or they have some sort of pathological thing going on. Three, people spend too much time looking at their phones. This is what's wrong with the world. We're all drones, we're all sucked in by technology, we all just stare at our phones, and the phone maybe is the problem. Four, millennials are just pissed off with the baby boomers who greedily fucked up the world, made them too resentful to do anything. I'm kind of sympathetic to that, but I don't think it's actually necessarily true. Five, the general precarity of work, and there's a lot written about this, precariousness means that there's no time to be active, it's too risky to be active, and there's a definite truth in this, but I don't think it gets really to the heart of the problem. So before I go on to say what I think are some of the reasons that apathy and alienation exist in society today, I do want to just question the premise of this whole entire session. And just give you a couple of statistics. Victorian socials. Volunteering Australia. A little less radical. Says 31% of people in Australia are engaged in formal volunteering activities, and that contributed to an estimated $290 billion to the economy annually of people doing things without getting paid for doing them because they think they're helping. That's a lot. In the United States, a quarter of the population volunteer. And the thing that's really increased in volunteering hours in the last few years, and the growing sector of the volunteering of volunteering in the United States, is collecting and distributing food. That's what people volunteers do in the United States, in the richest economy in the world, for free, because people think other people should be able to eat. Internationally, of course, we've seen some of the most heroic revolutionary movements in the last 10 years. Egyptian Revolution, Syria, what's happening in Algeria and Sudan right now. I should say that's a lot of young people who have smartphones in Sudan and Algeria. Workers across the West have also led massive strikes, more strikes in the United States in 2018 since there have been in 1986. Teachers leading the way, McDonald's workers, the Fight for 15 in Ireland, massive mobilisations for equal marriage, abortion rights in Australia, thousands of school and university students for the climate strikes. So there's a whole lot of examples that you can start going, okay, maybe there are people who are not so apathetic. But despite all of that, I do think that most of the time people aren't making revolutions. They're not leading strikes. They're not shutting shit down. So we've got to say, why is that? So I'm going to look at two things that I think are interconnected elements to answer this question. The first is ideology, and the second is alienation. In other words, ideology, don't worry, be happy. Alienation, you have no power, so don't bother. Ideology. One of the most major contradictions of capitalism is this. The constant promise of happiness and fulfillment versus the reality of life and work within capitalism. So structured around inequality, you need a whole lot of ideology to keep saying to people, no, no, it's all fine, 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 it's okay. So, you know, it's not actually structured around inequality, don't worry. Why is it that a childcare worker gets paid less than an IT worker in Australia? Why does the boss get 9/10 of the money and you get 1/10? 1/10 as a salary. Why are people in a situation where if you don't have enough money, you can't have a roof over your head? A whole framework of ideas or ideology is constantly reinforced to make what seems inherently unfair seem logical. Children are constantly told that things will get better, that even if school seems hard and arbitrary, that life after school will be full of choices and freedom and opportunities and ways to find happiness. The whole American dream, Australian dream, is a fantasy. And even if you don't consider the genocidal project that brought you modern Australia or the genocidal slave-owning foundations of the United States, that basic idea, if you study hard enough, work hard enough, make the right decisions, you can own your own home, have a fulfilling job, a loving family, a nice car, fun holidays, happiness, a great Instagram thread, and even if you're a woman, you can become a self-made billionaire like Kylie Jenner. Self-made. There's a favourite kind of academic left-wing author called Lauren Hillam, who published a book in 2011 called Cruel Optimism. And in it, she makes the case that investing in change is to risk disappointment, and that this disappointment may become so overwhelming it reduces our capacity to be hopeful for the future. Basically, our optimism is also our self-inflicted cruelty. She discusses the idea of a good life fantasy and asks, why do people stay attached to conventional good life fantasies, say, of enduring reciprocity in couples, families, political systems, institutions, markets, when the evidence of their instability, fragility, and dear cost abounds? Fantasy, she answers, is the means by which people hoard idealizing theories and tableaux about how they and the world add up to something. These fantasies are not driven by ordinary people. They're provided to us, at least in some basic frameworks, to keep exploitation in order. And Berlant rightly recognises, I think, that since 1990, more and more of these fantasies are beginning to fray beyond repair. In particular, the idea of upward mobility, job security, social equality, and lively, durable . So in order to cover these increasingly gaping contradictions, we offered and marketed a whole range of things to make us feel better about the situation, particularly those that can make a lot of profit. For example, the diet industry, beauty, wellness, products that focus on individual solutions, self-help, activity tracking, productivity apps, all of these kind of things that are supposed to make you a better person, give you more leisure time, and increase your happiness. On top of this self-make-yourself-happy push, we're also encouraged to think that someone else will fix it for us. So we either make ourselves happy or we look to someone else to fix it. The right members of parliament, more women on the boards of businesses, better redistribution of the tax system, maybe an academic turn would help, a renewed public discourse, and all of these kind of things. Basically, anything that keeps us from thinking that we need to be active changing the world. Berlant writes, what happens when these fantasies start to fray? Depression, dissociation, pragmatism, cynicism, optimism, activism, or an incoherent mash. What Berlant identifies without naming it directly is a politics of reformism that contributes to these outcomes. Pragmatism, cynicism, and most often disappointment. People who want to change the world but keep hitting a series of brick walls. It's not optimism or activism that is cruel. It is the whole architecture of ideology that continues to shape and enclose our hopes and dreams. And I think if you look then at what underpins all of this ideology, we have this fundamental challenge of the alienation that's built into the structures of capitalism. And Marx was not the only philosopher who's argued that there's nothing natural about alienation. Rousseau in the 18th century rejected the idea that human beings were selfish or aggressive by nature, as like Hobbes had argued. He wrote, it is only through their institutions that men become. become bad. So Rousseau identified that social organisation influences human behaviour, and Marx wanted to say then, well, what kind of social organisation is influencing our behaviour? What form of society do we live in, and what is producing these social institutions? So Marx recognised that capitalism is a system based on exploitation, divided by class, and that the labour process that we engage in under capitalism distinguishes us from other animals. While other animals do work on their environments, humans are able to labour in a conscious and creative way, and most importantly, in a collectively organised way. When the capitalist mode of production was literally forced upon the workers, through land clearances, urbanisation and all of that, we lost our individual ability to control anything about the labour process. And this commodification of labour power as something that could be measured in discrete units led to the creation of a fundamental abstraction tending towards a general homogenization of life. So labour power is then chunked up into these units that homogenize all aspects of things that we do that could be creative but aren't because they're trapped in this system. For example, just recently, or in the last couple of years, when I was working at La Trobe University, actually one of my colleagues, former colleagues is in the room here, there's this ongoing and bizarre dispute between the Tertiary Education Union and management about basically which units to measure academic and staff time in. And they don't want those units to be directly connected to actual time. They want it to be more abstract than that, so they have this bizarre formula about trying to obscure kind of the units that you can measure things. And then people are allocated points, and then you have to add up the point system, and it's different for different people. It's just really like takes the human being out of the whole equation. As Henry Ford famously said, why is it every time I ask for a pair of hands they come with a brain attached? Why do we have to have transferable skills if we're not in some sort of homogenized working environment? So we produce our units of labor, transact our money and our commodities, including everything that is essential to just staying alive. And the cherry on top of this unedifying reality cake is that the progress of capitalist development now means we're in a position where even with this alienated production process, sort of despite it in some ways, we have reached the possibility of being able to actually access self-realisation. So we have the technology, we have the creative power in our society, we don't need to be alienated. Pretty good. But we still have a system that functions in the same way, motivated by profit, commodifying labour, and so it has to find even more and more oppressive ways to deny that potential for us to unleash our own self-realisation through collective struggle. So it's kind of a cruel irony. And it's a cruel irony that Marx recognised even in the 19th century. And I think you can sort of see what he writes here in an even more magnified way today. So this is 1844, Marx. Labour produces wonderful things that for the rich, but for the worker it produces privation. It produces palaces, but for the worker hovels. It produces beauty, but for the worker deformity. Mm-hmm. It replaces labour by machines, but it throws one section of workers back into a barbarous type of labour, and it turns the other section into a machine. Produces intelligence, but for the worker, stupidity, cretinism. This deep alienation created by the labour process is then amplified in our alienation from the things we produce. So many of us can't afford to buy the things we contribute to making, to eat dinner in the restaurants we work in, to use the services that we deliver, and all of these kind of objects and things that we produce that are beyond our reach kind of take up this life force of their own that come to dominate it over us. Marx wrote, the more the worker spends himself, the more powerful becomes the alien world of objects which he creates over and against him. The poorer he himself, his inner world becomes, the less belong to him as his own. This is then reflected in and shapes the way we relate to each other. Economic relationships mediate all relationships between people, not just between bosses and workers, but between workers and other workers, between competing capitalists. And as workers, we're forced into this constant state of competition from the moment we start school, and our school adds up our grades, and they compare them to each other, and we're entered into league tables against other schools. And our parents read our reports and say, you shouldn't manhandle your peers. I don't know.
What kind of thug were you?
So we have this bizarre thing, and it's true. Like anyone in any, particularly like office workplaces, there's this thing where people like to talk about how busy they are all the time. And they might be busy, and they often are very busy, and then sometimes they're not busy, but they still say they're really busy and they're tired. It's like this virtuous thing, oh, I'm really busy. Or I've managed to save up and buy something, and it's really great. Or I've, you know, the idea that you can be employee of the month, obviously not if you're a socialist, you never want to be. Shame on you. But there is that idea that that's something you're supposed to do. And then add on top of that, there's all of this nationalist bullshit stuff, which in every Western nation is basically the same. You work hard, you get rewarded. There's a lot of values around that with all sorts of special phrases and things. And then pile on top of that, the idea about gender and the family is the most important thing. And I put in brackets, e.g., see every single reality TV show ever made. When every contestant has to sort of say their motivation for being on a thing, oh, I just think family is the most important thing. Have you ever seen anyone who says, nah, family's not that important? They couldn't get away with it. But it's that kind of ideology, and you think, oh, well, maybe they're all saying it like that. And so we're then told to achieve some kind of work-life balance, right? The idea that life is a bit of a... I think they made a bit of a mistake when they came up with this one. I don't think it was a worker who came up with it. I think it was a boss. But then they basically said that there's work and then there's life. It's like, that's the life part, and then... off we go to work. We should try and have a balance between the terrible, terrible and the life that you might try and be yourself in. So we have this kind of combination of economic and personal alienation. And I think those are the things that then shape our relationship, our response to politics. And politics is then presented as a category of activity that takes place outside of most people. So it takes politics as Canberra, the Canberra bubble. Oh yeah, people don't love the Canberra bubble. No, they don't, but then you're reinforcing the fact that there is a bubble. That's where it is. That's politics. Canberra, Spring Street, the White House, Westminster. In sort of white Western culture, it's not polite to talk about politics or religion at the dinner table. We're expected to believe, as well, that entire institutions, despite really obvious things happening over and over again, are neutral. The criminal justice system, the police, the education system, these are just neutral kind of things set up to help society run. So Marx described how human beings have been become more and more enslaved under a power alien to them, a power which has become more and more enormous, and in the last instance, turns out to be the world market. Everyone who was told they'd be able to afford the repayments on their mortgages in 2007, only to be repossessed by the banks in 2009, or who put their savings into a savings account in Northern Rock or like a whole bunch of other financial institutions, only to see it disappear, know just how heavy and unforgiving the invisible hand of the market can be. So what does all of this add up to? As individuals, particularly in the West, but all around the world, the result is that we are more miserable than ever. Major depression cases in America are climbing rapidly. A study of medical claims between 2013 and 2016 found diagnoses of major depression increased by 33%. The total of commercially insured Americans suffering from major depression is now over 9 million. Add to this, the number of opioid prescriptions dispensed by doctors per year has increased from 1992 of 112 million, which is still a lot, to now 282 million opioid prescriptions. 30 people a day die of opioid overdose in the US. Work is terrible for our physical and mental health, whatever kind of work you do. For people who sit in offices like me, terrible for your body, all kinds of muscular, skeletal disorders, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, even if you work out regularly. So, that's a little side there. People who commute. I was very happy to read that, actually. People who commute more than 10 miles by car have higher blood sugar, increased cholesterol, and increases your risk of depression, anxiety, and misery. One UK study that I found said that people who commute 30 minutes by bus have the lowest levels of life satisfaction. I understand that. I feel that. But even cyclists are not immune to the ill effects of heavy smoke. And of course, all of these kind of definitions, I think, can be called into question, all of this sort of pathologizing and stuff. But, and you know, what we consider an illness or a disorder and what actually is a difference or something that we just aren't really recognizing or valuing is very measurable and contextual according to the goals of a given society. So in capitalism's case, we focus on aspects of life that prevent ordinary people from participating in wage labor. I don't think in socialism we would have the same attitude. But what we do know, it's pretty obvious really to socialists and probably everyone in this room, that most measures of health and well-being, life expectancy, educational outcomes, interactions with the justice system and more are all connected with economic inequality. And while most of us are limited in our potential expressions of individuality, celebrities' individual choices are seen as very important and worth following. Being apathetic about politics while also being interested in celebrities, social media, and all of that kind of stuff, I think are equally connected to this fundamental sense of alienation. Although I do follow quite a lot of lesbians on Instagram. That's a celebrity lesbian question. And I need to, because actually all of this is very sobering and pretty bleak, even. Which does then make you think that in the face of that, the fact that people do organise and resist and take risks and fight back is actually pretty astounding. And what is more, these acts of resistance happen all the time, even if we don't hear about them, because why would the ruling class want to keep publicising our resistance? Whether it's the group of workers at Chemist Warehouse saying enough is enough and striking to say no more sexual harassment, or the teacher who leaves the staff meeting at 4:30 because they refuse to work unpaid overtime, or the students who gathered their friends and classmates on the platform at Castlemaine Station and said, let's go down to Melbourne and strike about the climate, or the Muslim women who came out and chanted the loudest at the anti-Islamophobia protest a few days after the Christchurch attack. We can all make a difference in prizing open the cracks in the system. I think that apathy can be turned into activism, that individualism can be turned into solidarity, that alienation can be overcome by revolutionary change and result in liberation. And I'm not just saying that because I want to believe it, I'm saying that because I think that history proves all of these claims to be true. If we can and when we can fundamentally change the way society is organised, what is produced, how it is produced, and more importantly, why it is produced, not for profit, but for people, a new way of experiencing life becomes possible. And this vision of a new way of experiencing life and the theory of a new way of experiencing life is called socialism. A thoroughly democratic way of organising society where people can be active in a whole amazing range of ways. In a socialist society, there is no reason for equality. We can solve the climate crisis. We could use the technical innovations that have been made to advance our lives instead of crushing them. And we could find genuine self-actualization. Work could be meaningful and self-expressive. And the idea of having a work-life balance would become a comedic relic of history. And even when we don't win socialism, our activism can make a difference, not just to change things now, but I think, more importantly even, to build the level of force we all need to smash the system for good. As as Marx and Engels wrote in the Communist Manifesto, we have nothing.